Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to share the latest on the controversy around which group lives the longest, vegetarians or meat eaters. That will be settled in a few moments. Then some Spanish researchers at the Valencia University have published in a major peer-reviewed journal an article talking about powdered fruit ingredients and how it can help people and why it's so important to get it that way. Also, green tea, new information on how diabetics can benefit. So we have the latest in peer-reviewed literature on health and healing. Today I'm going to try to tie as many possible commentary and social issues together in a short period of time, where normally I would write a long commentary. I'm going to do short pieces. I'm going to also look in-depth through the study by Jack Smith of Countercurrents on Obama's war record. He won the Nobel Prize. He'll be getting a lot of support in this election based upon how strong a militarist he is. Of course, he has to compete against Romney. It'll be interesting to see who talks about killing the most people and spending the most money and having the biggest army. It's all about size with these two people, isn't it? What does that tell you? Also, they've just come out with a list of America's 25 most inspiring companies. Well, wonder what makes a company inspiring. The list is surprising. I'm going to then examine, in a commentary, what we can do to reverse our decaying infrastructure, how we can put people back to work. I'm also going to take issue with J.P. Morgan and how lowlife they are in harassing people, calling them at work through their agencies to collect their debt. And I'm going to balance that against the fact that they, J.P. Morgan, have received trillions, not billions, not hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars from the Federal Reserve, but no one asks, shouldn't with all this money that we, the American public, who's guaranteeing this money from the Federal Reserve, shouldn't you then start to do something different in how you approach how you collect your debts? Otherwise, what does it say about we, the people? Also today, if time permits, I'm going to talk about, from our environmental section, when we bombed Iraq, we left a toxic legacy in Fallujah and Basra. I want us to go back and take a look at what that means today, because there's a new study out on it. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Oh, and I'll throw my own questions at this, what I call non-election election. You know, when you vote for one of the two or lesser evils, you're still in hell. So what's the point of that exercise? We do have some third-party candidates that wouldn't be the worst of anything. So I'll deal with my views on the critical issues that will not be discussed tonight. My guest also today will be talking about how and why America performs so poorly in healthcare, safety, education, democracy, inequality among the world's developed nations. Professor Howard Stephen Friedman from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a leading statistician and health economist at the United Nations will be on to discuss that. Let's begin. I have received so many emails over the years talking about why vegetarianism isn't the right way to go, and you can't be strong and healthy if you're a vegetarian. Really? Well, we've got a Mr. World and Mr. Universe. We've got some of the top athletes, Carl Lewis, one of the greatest Olympians of all time. And for those of us who are athletes, want to come run a race with Sid Howard or Sam Skinner? See how well you do? They're vegans. In fact, let any woman her age race against Thelma Wilson, a vegan, Louise Nottage, a vegan. They're the best in the world. In fact, look at the strongest, longest-lived creatures on the planet. Lions, tigers, crocodiles, they live a long life. Lions and tigers, 10 to 12 years. Elephants, vegans, up to 100 years. The longest-lived creature that we know of is the Galapagos turtles. They can live up to 200 years. So it's not true that meat eating in animals extends the lifespan. What about with humans? Well, this latest study just came in today. It is at a conference, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the Food and Nutrition Conference. And here's what the research team had to say. They reviewed 96,000 United States and Canadian citizens, and they were based upon meat-eating diets or vegetarian diets. Here's what they found. Quote, listen up. Vegetarians have a longer life expectancy than meat eaters. In fact, 9.6 years longer. Plus, they weigh 13 kilograms lighter. That's about 30 pounds lighter. So they don't suffer the same level of heart attacks, strokes, diabetes. They're less likely to smoke. They're more likely to exercise regularly. And all of these put together show that it's substantially protective and makes a big difference. So there's the statistics. And if you are a vegetarian today, you can reasonably expect to live in good health, 83.3 years for man and 80.57 years for woman. That's 9.5 years longer than a meat eater. Now, what if we also dealt with stress better? What if we took our supplements? Because these people weren't taking supplements. So what if we took a look at the diet and said, well, okay, can we make a super powerful diet, not just a vegetarian diet? Because you can be a vegetarian and not necessarily eat all the best foods. In fact, there's one vegan restaurant in Manhattan that's very popular. The number one source of protein in the restaurant is seitan, which is a highly processed gluten from wheat. And I'll deal with wheat and gluten and how bad it is on another issue. But then it's deep fried. In fact, most of the food in that restaurant is deep fried and not healthy, but it's very popular. So if you were to take someone who had a high quality of life, really healthy, wonderful relationships, exercise, took their supplements, then I'm going to say that you could increase that lifespan by about 20 years. So right now we can reasonably expect that a healthy, all-around health at an optimal level, I'm going to say 105 to 110 is what you could reach without disease. But even if you are not taking your supplements and you're not in the best relationships and you're not dealing with stress and you're not doing the full amount of exercise, you're still going to live about 9 years longer than a meat eater. So finally, that argument is settled. Because that's not the first to show how much longer you live as a vegetarian. I was very intrigued by some Valencia University in Spain, which is our major university. They did some research, and they found that when they freeze-dried some grapefruit and kiwi and strawberries, that they were able to conserve the bioactive ingredients, and that they believe that this would be extremely beneficial because of the high level of antioxidant levels. And here's what they said, and quote, the grapefruit is a citrus fruit with great nutritional and functional value, but its consumption is very small for several reasons, because it's bitter. Meanwhile, strawberries are seasonal and not available year-round, and kiwis are also seasonal. And there are also kiwis higher in vitamin C content. And that can strengthen the body. And therefore, they're advocating something new and revolutionary. Powdering fruits so that they could, quote, be ready to sprinkle on foods and could act as functional ingredients So this is a big deal, and I commend them on that. Except I wouldn't select grapefruit as a superfruit, nor kiwi. Strawberries would make it in, but at the bottom of the list, not the top. And they're 25 years late. Because some of you in this audience, I know for a fact, are having your dried, but not freeze-dried. They're naturally dried at 88 degrees. Therefore, enhance even a greater amount of the nutritional benefit. And with super nutrients that they're not even aware of. They're looking at the antioxidants, not the antioxidant fruit that's protective. It's the phytonutrients. That's what makes a difference, like the polyphenols. So it's amazing how a major university is getting a lot of attention with a major study that's 25 years after the horse out of the gate. But for those in the audience who've been using your dried fruit powders, it's nice to know that you're a quarter century ahead of everyone else, but way far ahead in the functional food quality of what you put in your body to protect your cells, rejuvenate your cells, repair the damaged enzymes, rejuvenate the probiotics in your intestine, heal the lining of your intestine, help bring down your blood pressure, naturally thin your blood. All that is reasonably expected as an outcome when you increase the amount of fruits and vegetables each day in your diet. Now, for those of you who've been using green tea, and there are many ways of using it, you can actually take some tea and a tea bag and put it in hot water, or you can get a capsule and take it. Depends upon the milligrams. But whatever form you take it, look for the EGCG content, because that's what makes it powerful. And here is the latest from a new study from Penn State. It says green tea impacts blood sugar management and therefore may help suppress the digestion of sugar and control blood sugar levels and makes it better. And this was published in Molecular Nutrition and Cell Research. Quote, this is a compelling case for studies in human subjects. Well, hello, once again, you're way behind. Here's my suggestion for the researchers over at Penn State in the Department of Food and Nutrition. Go to the scientific literature references. Look under Chinese and Japanese studies. You'll find about 6,000 highly controlled, population-based, not lab-based, studies on the benefits of green tea. And you'll see the compelling studies, case for studies in humans. It's been done thousands of times. Isn't it amazing what happens when you actually get tenured in a university, how the rest of the world just doesn't matter anymore? Because you're safe, you're protected. You live in an ivory tower, and you don't have to look around and see that you're way behind the curve. But that's also part of our arrogance. And if we are the most arrogant nation ever, because we believe, I'll tell you how arrogant we are, that if there's any benefit in science, in medicine, in healthcare, let's say in Israel, where they have some outstanding scientists, or Germany, or Italy, or France, or Russia, or England, none of those are ever accepted. You can't take something done in those countries and used on the population and tested and retested for safety and efficacy and bring it in the United States. Why? Because we didn't test it, and therefore it has to go all through a whole process all over again. That, and yet we're the country that leads the world in killing more of our citizens each year with our so-called proven safe and effective drugs. We just can't get anything right. And yet, so many other places in the world, they've been living longer and healthier lives, and we refuse to accept it. Well, get over it. Now, also, there's a new study from the American Academy of Neurology, published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology, which shows that what many of you already know, plaque buildup in your brain is more harmful than having an Alzheimer's gene, which I challenge. And they're actually acknowledging that now for the first time. Why? Because the gene presupposes that there's nothing you can do. Well, first, that's never been proven. with any gene that may be predictive, a lifestyle intervention can always change the outcome. But if you assume that because you don't have a gene, there's nothing you can do, good or bad, that would impact your brain, then you're going to keep making bad choices. Now, just look at it this way. The plaque that builds up in our arteries, which leads to atherosclerosis, a closing of those arteries, and destruction of the epithelial tissue, is the same way that it builds up in our brain. But it's called an amyloid plaque in the brain. But it's the same way. And here's the background on this. And this, again, is part of just the absurdity of science, as we know. It's a monotheistic-based science, meaning, I'll just give you an actual example. Let's say that you do a study on vitamin C, and you show that vitamin C helps take away the pain in the joints of a person suffering from arthritis. Well, then the question is, would that same vitamin C help take away the pain in the muscles of a person suffering from fibromyalgia? Well, there's a high probability it would. But they won't say that because they didn't do a separate research. So they wouldn't say vitamin C is good for you and it's an anti-inflammatory. They'll only say what specifically they've been able to prove, even though reason and logic would show that that would it help other similar types of pain because it's working on the same foundational basis. It's limiting the impact of cytokines and tumor necrosis factor. Similarly, if you said that inflammation in your joints is bad and therefore you have to protect your joints, why wouldn't the same inflammation that's circulating in your blood every 6.5 minutes through your body, why wouldn't it be bad for the heart or for the eyes or for the brain or for your lungs or for your pancreas? Well, of course it would be, but not in their minds. In their minds, we don't have proof that inflammation is bad for the brain because we didn't do the actual study. So this is what you find in the infantilism of American science. It's just stupid. So if you have inflammation, you have systemic inflammation. It's going through your whole body. There is no basis in science. There is no basis in the mechanism of body biochemistry that can tell anyone ever that you just drank a toxin, you just took some arsenic. Strychnine. It will only impact your intestine. But hold on, if it's poison that goes in my body, isn't that going to be carried by the blood everywhere else? But we only did the study on your intestine. But if it's a poison, wouldn't it affect other organs and other glands? Because the blood's going to carry it, and wherever the blood goes, which is every cell in your body, 50 to 100 trillion cells, won't it damage it? We haven't done that study yet. You mean reality only begins when you've been able to scientifically verify it? Yes. So I can never use intuition. I can never use just common sense. I can never use a reasonable judgment. I can never use logic. I can never use innate knowledge. No. No. Only what has been proven. That is 100% of how we live our lives today. And you wonder why we have problems. Well, that just gives you an idea. So when it comes to plaque, and they're now telling us for the first time, the gee whiz, the plaque building up in your brain is also a problem. So they thought, what? It's only if you have the gene that you could have Alzheimer's. But how about all the people, 95% of the people get Alzheimer's, don't have the gene? It's just a disconnection from reality. So every time you eat a hot dog, a hamburger, French fries, every time you have a cup of coffee, every time you have a soda, every time you have a bagel, a pretzel, you are also creating inflammation in small amounts, but nonetheless it's cumulative. And that causes inflammation in the brain, and that can cause a plaque buildup in the brain. And we now have, according to the latest study, nearly 2 billion, that's with a B, billion dementia patients coming at us. This is from Alternet, from Laura Gottensdinger. 2 billion dementia patients, medical establishment shocked by at-risk numbers on the horizon. Quote, no one understands how it happens. Every day, the minds of millions of high-functioning people slowly dip into another reality, one in which life events, loved ones' faces, children's names, and all the other memories that constitute a person's identity have disappeared. Deep inside their brains, the slide begins decades before the symptoms of dementia manifest. By the time the car keys begin to go missing, it's already far too late. Certainly, there are about 36 million people in the world suffering from dementia. But in the near future, the population at risk for the disease is expected to hit 2 billion, causing an estimated $1 trillion a year just to treat Alzheimer's in the United States. Quote, the scope of the looming medical care disaster is beyond comparison with anything that's been faced during the entire history of humanity, end quote. Dr. Barry Greenberg, Director of Strategy for the Toronto Dementia Research Alliance. Let me get back here a moment. No one understands how it happens. Well, it seems though today all I'm doing is talking about people who seem to be living in a bubble somewhere. There's a woman in this audience. Her name is Marie McGovern. She's appeared, I believe, 12 times on this program. You can see her on the internet. If you go to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and you will see her under caption, unrehearsed, non-coached, talking about what happened after about 16 to 17 months on an anti-Alzheimer's protocol that she was on with a group of people. You will also see a man named Kenny. Kenny is a plumber from New Jersey who had advanced multiple sclerosis, the type that you go from not being able to walk to a wheelchair to a bed to death. Kenny has been given a 100% clean bill of health. His neurologist can find no demyelinization, no lesions in his spinal cord or his brain. He is normal and healthy. Marie McGovern, who's gone through a traffic accident and had to recover infection in her leg from the hospital that nearly killed her. She had a lot of crisis, but she was able to go from having end-stage Alzheimer's, I mean Ronald Reagan end-stage, to a completely vital brain again, able to function, able to carry on conversations, to read any kind of book. She was an instructor at New York University. She's able to go to the museums that she once took her clients and students and explain once again the intricacies and the wonder of art. And she is, you'd sit and have a conversation with her, you would think she's a completely normal person in spite of the other injuries she suffered from and is recovering from. So no one understands how it happens. Well, how could you reverse it if you didn't understand how it got there? Now, maybe the people in orthodox medicine and science who receive $14 billion a year don't understand it, but there's a lot of people in this audience who do, and the people who've reversed Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and multiple sclerosis, they do. It's simple. Anything that creates inflammation and is cumulative over a period of time will finally create enough of a cellular destruction, enough of a amyloid plaque buildup, enough of demyelinization of the sheath, enough of the neuron destruction and the breaking of the dendrites that you tip into flip a coin. Flip a coin. Is it dementia, Alzheimer's, ALS? Because you can't control it. There is no predetermined idea that you're going to end up with one of these. It's just whatever your own particular and unique body manifests as the symptoms. So then why don't you walk it back? Walk back 20, 30, and 40 years and take an honest, careful, detailed, methodical look at the choices you've made. And then ask yourself, did anything that I do or how I processed my life, contribute to this tipping? And the answer is always yes. But those are questions as a society we're not willing to ask. Why? Because if we ask for the truth, we'd see that our entire lifestyles that we're living in today are wrong on almost every level. Our diet, our behavior, where we live, the overconsumption, the toxic environment, the ingredients we use from the pillow that outgasses to the mattress that outgasses to the bleach in the sheets, to the plastic baby bottles, to the plastic water bottles, to the fluoridated water, to the particulate matter in the air, to the electromagnetic pulses from the cell phones, to the highly processed diet, to the nutrient deficiencies, to the high levels of cortisol, to the lack of exercise, to the lack of the vital relationship with nature. All of those are pieces of the puzzle. So 3 out of 3, 3 institutions, 3 reports, and all of them way behind the curve. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love. Sister, don't punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on.
Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guest here in just a second. We have Jason in the studio. I'm out on the road. I'll be on the road right up until proposition is voted yes or no. I just want you to know that they're spending $1 million a day to convince California voters to say no to the Proposition 37. And we, a small handful of people who have some tools to educate the public, Jeffrey Smith, and what we're doing, we've put out to, yesterday was part 4 of a 6-part documentary in California, plus other individuals. We're saying yes. But we don't have the money, we don't have the influence, the Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, they're on the side of the genetic engineering companies. So we were about 67%, now we're way down. If the vote were held tomorrow, we would lose. If we lose there, we pretty much lose nationwide. If we win there, we could win nationwide and put genetic engineering on the ropes. So that's why I will keep doing what I'm doing till we have an outcome. And as many people as you can get to say that you know in California to vote yes, and they just need some encouragement and they need some education. And we have hundreds of articles, hundreds on our website by scientists and by activists showing why genetic engineering is not the way to go. It's bad to the bone on all levels. Before we go to Professor Howard Stephen Friedman, I gave you his background, Professor Columbia University, School of International and Public Affairs, and he's a leading health economist at the United Nations. And in the past, he's worked with UNICEF and the World Health Organization, and he is also the author of The Measure of a Nation, How to Regain America's Competitive Edge and Boost Global Standing. And we're going to talk about how and why America performs so poorly in health care, safety, education, democracy, and equality among the world's developed nations, none of which will be acknowledged in the debate, none of which can be acknowledged by the talking heads on television and the ideologues who believe that everything America does, it does with exceptionalism, that they are absolutely manifest destiny believers to the hilt, and they have large constituents who support that. We'll be taking that on with Howard in just a moment. But Jason, our program director, is in the studio. Hi, Jason.
Hi, good afternoon, Gary. I just like you had said a few minutes ago, we are the main source for Progressive Minds with great articles. We would like to thank everyone who joins us to read our great articles and great podcasts who have been coming at record numbers, over 200,000 a week, which is going to lead us to the best year ever of having over 13 million people view different stuff on our site, which includes articles, podcasts, and great information from great Progressive Minds who not only work here for us, but also work all over the country. So we really appreciate everyone coming and to keep joining us in these great, great numbers, and we really appreciate the fan support.
Okay. I also was told, I don't know, I haven't seen it, but we have over 1,250,000 new listeners, mainly young women, between 35, according to Google Analytics, 35 and 45 listening, college-educated listening, downloading progressive-themed shows from their homes. Is that correct?
That is 100% correct, Gary. We have a great audience that is definitely growing and getting younger with us, and we hope to just grow with them and grow with them for many years.
Those are young, new people, plus
exactly.
We have a humongous older audience. So altogether, we're getting the message out, and that's the whole point.
Yes,
there,
sir.
There is now a place for Progressive Minds to come and get information and then can use that to improve the larger world we live in, to help use the tools for social causes, to share and be a part of a commitment of making it a better world.
And 24/7 as well, Gary. So that's what's great about this as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Professor Howard Friedman, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What have been the drawbacks of America perceiving itself as a meritocracy compared with other nations?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. Our whole country is premised on this idea of the American dream, that we're the land of opportunity, and we believe it to our core. On surveys, Americans believe it's more of a meritocracy than in other countries. But the data, and my book is very much driven on data, shows just the opposite, that you're more likely to stay poor in the United States if you were born poor than in other wealthy countries. The other countries have far more social mobility, and we can talk a little bit about why that's so, but that fact in itself to me is very surprising and one that people don't realize.
Okay. I'm concerned on several issues. There's a report that came out today saying that only three countries in the world don't have mandatory paid maternity family leave: the U.S., Papua New Guinea, and Swaziland. So what does that tell us about the way we as a nation care and raise children compared to other developed nations?
Well, it certainly sends a message, but that's just one small example of a systematic difference in how the U.S. approaches not just the health, something that I know you talk a lot about, but all aspects of its society. You know, when you compare the United States to other wealthy countries, not just in its legal practices and how they protect and help develop young children, but all throughout its system, we're very different from other countries, and then the data shows that not just are we different, but often we don't do as well. And that's really the key premise. When we're not doing as well, what can we learn from other countries?
One observance is that there's appearing more and more frequently analysis and commentaries noting the U.S. is no longer a true democracy compared to other democratic nations. Could you explore this concept, please?
Well, it's a really great point you raise there. If you look at how can I measure democracy, one of the easiest ways to do it is to look at voter turnout. And the U.S. has one of the lower voter turnouts of any major wealthy democratic country. So people don't show up to the polls. But more importantly, how your vote is counted and how we vote in the United States is very different from other major democracies. We use these winner-take-all elections for Congress, for instance. And in doing so, lots of people who didn't vote for the quote-unquote winner see that their points of view are ignored. You have gerrymandering. It's very difficult to get a third party to have any voice. And that's because of these single-seat winner-take-all elections. 38 of 41 leading democratic countries use proportional representation, a way that your votes can be reflected in the distribution of the parties. And, of course, we know how anti-democratic the Electoral College is, or just the lack of representation that D.C. has, Washington, D.C. residents have in Congress. So just tremendous undermining of democracy in a couple of those areas.
I've spent my entire adult life in the health field, and my entire time, I've never seen, not once, has the United States government as a whole, led by the U.S. Public Health Service, our major agencies, the Surgeon General, have a health program that would actually prevent the majority of diseases we now see are preventable, and to offer people the understanding of how they can participate in their own healing process in association with those who are trained to guide them in this process. Instead, I see that we focus upon our effort. The reward, the money, the fame is in the efforts. So all these foundations, whether it's the American Cancer Society or the American Heart Association or the Diabetes Association or Arthritis Foundation, they get all the money. They corner all this. They control the dialogue. They control what we're supposed to understand. And as a result, I don't see anybody coming forward and being honest about what really causes most of our illnesses. And then I look in other countries when I travel the world, I have to ask, how is it that in all these other places around the world, they have completely different health statistics? U.S. has the lowest life expectancy at 77.9 years. Japan has the highest. We have the highest infant mortality, 6.7 out of 1,000. We have the highest maternal death rate. That's terrible, 24 out of 100,000. We have the most expensive health care in the world. To spend one night in just a bed without any medical treatment, nurse treatment, or food in a hospital in New York is over $1,200. I could get a suite in the Waldorf Astoria for that price. How did we get to this place? Could you define some of this and answer it as you will?
Sure. Now, one of the key things that you cited in those statistics, and to me the take-home one, is just that the U.S. spends 2 to 4 times more on health per person than other wealthy countries, and we have the lowest life expectancy of those wealthy countries. So that's the key statistic. How did we get there? You know, at its core, it's because these other countries have universal health care systems where the government plays a somewhat different role, either in as being the insurer or the provider. The United States has the for-profit health system for most of our areas, and that's where we get into a lot of issues, because while economists will try to argue that this is a good system for providing health, they're ignoring the simple facts of the law of supply and demand. So what I mean by that is people will continue to demand health care, whether the health care costs $100, $1,000, or $10,000. And so you end up with a for-profit health system that can continue to charge more and more prices. But the other thing, and this is something that I know is very fundamental to a lot of the points that you raise, is we really have to have serious conversations about diet. And let me give you an example with that. Japan has one of the longest life expectancies of any wealthy country. And it's not just because their health system is more comprehensive using this Bismarck model, but their diet is sufficiently better. They eat about 1,000 calories less per day. The food quality is higher. It's not just the fish content, but the overall food quality is higher. And they end up having an obesity rate that's in the low single digits, while in the United States, we have obesity rates of 30% or higher. So that's just key examples right there between our health system and the actions that we take as Americans that are critical to improving our health care. Lessons learned from other countries that we can adopt.
I would agree with that. I think you've made some salient points. What I would share that would give a little different perspective is I've also seen that our politicians and our physicians are fully aware of what causes disease. Speak with them one-on-one, and they can explain it. If they have a kid and you ask them, well, you know, if you're going to give your kid all this high fructose corn syrup and let them drink 30-ounce liters of soda a day, are they going to be normal weight or overweight? They're going to say they're going to be overweight. You know, there's no mystery. You don't have to be a scientist to figure this out. and then but ask them, would you have the courage to take on McDonald's, the sugar lobby, the cereal lobby? And the answer is no, because these lobbies are smart enough to give lots of money to campaigns, to fund universities, departments. The pharmaceutical company literally controls almost one-third of all the research going on in major institutions today, and therefore they get to determine the outcome, and yet they use the moniker of the university for their own reputation. So how then do we get the message? Because it's never going to come from official sources. It's not going to come from the mainstream media. It's got to come from the ground up. It's got to come from holistic dietitians, nutritionists, holistic nurses, massage therapists, chiropractors. I believe it has to come from people who are not a part of the official power structure and profit structure if we're going to ever change the way that we live. Your thoughts?
I think that there's enough out there in the mainstream, at least in the examples you gave. The high fructose corn syrup, it's been covered very well in the mainstream media. People are aware of it. Now, that doesn't mean that means we've now changed how people are practicing. And I think that's the bigger challenge, because I think that for some areas, you're right, there's a lack of awareness. And I think awareness is a barrier for change in everything that I discuss in my book. But in some of these areas, I think people are aware. They're making conscious choices to not change their diet. And we do have an economic system that's incenting that to be the cheaper product. Here in New York City, Mayor Bloomberg has been going through his efforts of trying to make it more inconvenient for someone to purchase huge amounts of, let's say, soda, and that's become politically controversial as well for many reasons. But I think awareness is certainly the first thing we have to address, and in some areas, people are aware and they're choosing not to change, but complacency is another huge factor that has to be addressed, both on the individual level and at the political level. And fully agree, there's some areas where we need to get people outside the mainstream to help raise awareness, but some of these, they're really fully in the mainstream. People know about them. They're just choosing not to do things.
Well, I would certainly support that contention. I just want to ask you in a few other areas, if you don't mind.
Please.
On democracy issues. We're going to have this debate tonight, and I don't believe anything that's really relevant to sustainable future is going to be discussed. They're not going to talk about global warming in any meaningful way. They're not going to talk about the danger of climate change adversely affecting crops. They're not going to talk about the expanding militarization. They're going to talk about things they can control the outcome in the viewing public's mind. One observance is that there's appearing more and more that we no longer are a real democracy. You said that we have one of the lowest voter turnouts, and I would suggest that if we actually promoted third parties and gave a Jill Stein, gave a Rocky Anderson, gave a Gary Johnson a chance to debate on these issues, that more Americans might be inspired to vote for instead of being apathetic. Because when I spoke with all of them, and I had them all on my show, mm-hmm. and I said, don't spin, don't tell me anything other than yes or no. You can explain the yes or no's later. I just want to know yes or no. No ambiguity. Would you support a single health care payer? Yes. Would you support the demilitarization of the world, getting rid of all these bases and getting all these conflicts? Yes. Would you repeal the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, the National Defense Authorization Act? Yes. Would you close the Federal Reserve, turn that over to the Treasury? Yes. I went through 35 very important issues. All of them agreed on these, and then later explained why they agreed on them. Both Romney and the president disagreed. They would have taken no on every single one of the issues that these people took yes on, and yet the people that could actually create a sustainable, peaceful, coexisting world that would deal with climate change, that would penalize the manufacturers of toxic products that continue this, they are never given a forum. So how in the world can we pretend that we have a real democracy when the people that would offer some options are not even invited to the discussion? Your thoughts?
And I couldn't agree more that we need third-party voices. This is something that I hammer home in the book, and I talk about some of the issues with it, but I really like that you went back to the presidential election, because what a lot of people don't realize is the Election Commission basically implemented a rule that forced people to have a pre-debate voting rate of over a certain number in order to be invited. It was a strategy that was done specifically to make sure the debate only had two people in it. And I think that you need to have the people at the conversation in order to hear that there are other viable options. And I'll give you an interesting example for a second. I had the pleasure of meeting and chatting with Governor Ventura recently, and what he told me was before the debate in Minnesota, he was polling roughly 10%-ish range. After the debate, when people got to hear him discuss his vision, his ideas for his state, suddenly his polling exploded, and of course we know he got elected. So I think it's important to figure out how to get people at the table, but there are so many other barriers we have to address. In our particular system, the way the states allocate their voters, the Electoral College, causes most states to do this all or none, and that forces us to get into a two-party system. But you don't have to do it that way. Two states in the United States actually allocate their votes according to proportional representation. By allocating their votes, that means you can show up as a third party and have a strong conversation in Maine or Nebraska, and you have the opportunity to start grabbing some Electoral College votes. So I think that there are ways to do it, but it means that people have to undo some of the inertia. And what I mean by that is so much of what we're doing is following a blueprint from 1787, even though democracies and how you vote has improved. The technology has gotten better. And we can learn from Canada and how they do things. Or, for instance, in Germany, France, Belgium, and Austria, they all pre-enroll their citizens. So you don't have this whole process of two-step where you have to register and then go ahead and vote. And we know that ends up alienating many minority groups. So there's better practices out there. But getting the third party out is critical, and I think that proportional representation is really the way to do it. You can have proportional representation implemented in Congress with only one change in the federal laws. So this is doable. Of course, you have to make Congress do something. That's the challenge. But it is doable. You don't have to change the Constitution. And you could have the Electoral College allocated votes. Each state, based on proportional representation, it's a state-level decision. So it's doable.
I would agree with that. I would also suggest that the way we heal our system is outlaw and ban all money from all elections. And that would make a difference because then you wouldn't have people buying elections. And also, when people keep reverting back and I hear these candidates all to our great founding fathers and the institution they put together, it was a group of racists. Take a look at it. Oh, yeah, they were Democratic. Women couldn't vote. Blacks couldn't vote. Latinos couldn't vote. Native Americans couldn't vote. But they were absolutely Democratic. Jesus,
well,
it's embarrassing.
You know, the thing that's interesting is when I hear people go back and, you know, they do this reverence to the founding fathers, and yes, I mean, couldn't agree more with you the fact that these were rich, white, landowning males who wanted to preserve their property. But what they don't understand is that when they wrote the Constitution, it wasn't meant to be a document to last for hundreds of years. The intention was that there would be a constitutional convention every 20 or so years and rewrite the document based on what you learned. Now, imagine what would happen today if you had that constitutional convention and you recognized everything that we've learned, all of our failures, not just in terms of how our political parties interact, but how we elect presidents, the Supreme Court, the whole concept that someone is there for life. These are a lot of issues that could be addressed if you had a constitutional convention. Now, I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but it's worth, whenever I hear someone talking about reverence for the founding fathers, besides, of course, pointing out the limitations that you did, I also point out that their intention was not for this to be a document forever, but to rewrite it every 20 years.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us, something to think about, and, of course, The Measure of a Nation, your new book, How to Regain America's Competitive Edge and Boost Our Global Standing. Thank you very much for coming on today, Professor Friedman.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Howard Stephen Friedman, my guest. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with some... I'm going to open this up also for our talkback segment, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And I want to say a special hello to all of our listeners listening on WPFW, Washington Metro Area, KPFK, Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, and all the other stations carrying us around the world. Back in a moment. I would like to see critical foreign policy questions be raised that will not be. Example, what exactly is the end game on the global war on terror? Now we're to believe that our precious resources that should be supporting public education and helping those who need it most in our society and forgiving all, I mean 100% of the interest on student loans and credit cards, so that the people have a chance who are finding it challenging having a job that is meaningful and a living wage can have a chance to actually pay back the principal. That I don't have a problem with. The interest, no, because the very bank, like J.P. Morgan, that has received over $2 trillion, $2.3 trillion, is now putting enormous pressure through one of its subsidiaries to collect money. And they're doing it in unethical and illegal ways. And they've actually, that company has paid fines. They call one person at work over 50 times and threatening them. And yet, we're giving money to J.P. Morgan that then goes out there and charges usurious rates. J.P. Morgan and all the other banks, they want you to not be able to pay the interest so they can then charge you compounding interest that is out of the contract. It can go up into the 100 percentile. Yet they got that money for zero interest in the Fed. When are we going to stop giving the Fed the power to give money to these banks that are just criminal organizations? So I say a massive movement to forgive all student interest 100%. Don't pay a penny. And then I believe that we should have strikes in every college and university, close down every college and university in the United States with a general strike until two things happen. A, you're allowed to file bankruptcy, get out of them, and B, there's no longer an interest on any student loan. Now, you want something to occupy your time, occupy your energy? Why don't you occupy the campuses and say no to the big banks and say no to the politicians like Christopher Dodd who caused those laws to be in place? Also, I'd like to see us stop the war on terror, because all it's doing is allowing special interest groups and Halliburton and all these other companies to get $80 billion a year in our secret wars around the world. And that money should be at home, helping with our infrastructure, deghettoizing America. Also, how you intend to win this war? What exactly are you going to do? Just go in and occupy every country? What exactly is your intent? They won't tell you. I would demand they tell us. Also, do they intend to retire the Constitution? We just discussed this. I believe that the Constitution today, as it is applied, is no longer valid because they've made it invalid. The very people who gave us Red Scares and the Palmer Raids, McCarthyism, have taken our First Amendment and they've shredded it. Yeah, they'll say, well, it covers nude artworks and comic books. Okay, but why is it that if Chris Hedges speaks about the war or the administration in front of the White House, he's now a terrorist suspect? Where's his freedom of speech? Where's our freedom of speech? What have you done to our constitutional rights? The First Amendment, the whistleblowers are no longer protected. Any whistleblower in the government is now prosecuted. Seven have been prosecuted by this president. Journalists that speak the truth and show corruption, like WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, they're now considered terrorists. Where is their First Amendment protection? What happened to the Fourth and the Fifth Amendments? You're spying, Mr. President, on Americans. Mitt Romney, you'd spy on anyone. I wouldn't trust you and your Mormon friends for a heartbeat, because you are just a homicidal nut job. You and everyone who believes in you. And Obama, you're the scary one, because you're the smooth one. And you got a lot of people drinking the Kool-Aid. What have you done to spy on Americans at home? To kill people with drones? What have you done with your National Defense Authorization Act? What have you done to concentrate power? So, why aren't these going to be discussed? What do you want in the Middle East? Do you want their oil? Be honest about it. Just say, we want your oil, and we're going to take it. At least we would know the truth of what everyone else in the world knows. What do you want with Israel? You want what? You've forgotten completely Palestine. What do you want in Bahrain? A dictatorship. Saudi Arabia, a royal family that acts as dictators. What do you want? Just be honest with us. We can handle it. You want to promote exceptionalism, the American way? Well, that becomes genocide to those of us who have a brain. Those are my thoughts. We'll speak with others. We're coming up to the end of our regular program. For those of you who want to continue, I'll give you a phone number you can listen to, or you can listen for the next 5 minutes over progressradionetwork.com. Otherwise, we thank you for giving us this hour of your time and hold this election cycle critical. Remember, you do have third-party candidates. Don't waste a vote, but don't acquiesce to these Tweedledee and Tweedledo, the corporate lobbyist. Our number is 832-280-0066. You can listen to this program anywhere in North America and Canada. 832-280-0066. Now let's say hello to Evett from NIAC. Hi, Evett. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. This is my lunch hour, and I'm just happy to get the opportunity to ask you this question. I'll be going to a town meeting this evening, and I want to know what knowledge you have about desalinization of the water.
And you're in where? NIAC, New York?
NIAC. Yeah, okay. They're promoting, they want to pass desalination of the water, and I don't know enough about it.
And why do they want to do this? What is the purpose? Who's promoting it?
That's a good question. I wish I had all the facts together. It's just a recent thing I'm finding out about.
Find out how they intend to do this.
Right.
And who's behind it. And then find out who's sponsoring it.
Right.
Then Google them and then send that information to you. Then I can show you how you deconstruct an issue to find out what the real agenda is.
All right. Who's sponsoring it?
Yes. All right.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Lou Ann Panessa, your turn.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
I have an email here from someone named Richard, and he's concerned about this. He said he found out on the internet that there's a gonorrhea superbug, that it's resistant to antibiotics, and he's very, very concerned about it. And he wants to know what your thoughts are on this.
It's called a condom. Jesus. First,
okay.
understand that we have a population with weakened immune systems. And the weaker your immune system, the more you are to resistant, all forms of resistance. Who do you think gets MRSA? People who have a weakened immune system in hospitals. But then you have a challenged immune system, you get a break in your skin, you're playing soccer or football, you get infected, you go to the hospital, you can knock it out, but I would be using ozone therapy as the way to knocking these out of the system, and then using natural antibiotics with that, it's hard to take because it's a deep, dark resin, but bee propolis is phenomenal for that, and colloidal silver is also phenomenal. All right?
Okay.
We're out of time. Thank you.
Hey, you Tracy there?
Yes, indeedy.
Excellent. We'll start soon.
Yes, sir.